welcome to another very special episode of Let Me Explain You a Thing. My name is Andrew, and this is the podcast where I talk extemporaneously on a subject, and it's extra extemporaneous today, I guess. I talk extemporaneously on a subject that I know a decent amount about, usually on my drive to work, although today we're heading home. And yeah, so today, we're heading home, but yeah, wow, I'm really beefing the intro today. But that's why we do it live for these, it's just like improv comedy, or improv of any kind, doesn't have to be comedy. You're just listening for the kind of, odd vagaries and, interesting little details that can only be achieved through an improvised medium with no refinement, rehearsal, or editing. So we are in rare form on this one. Welcome to the show. And apologies for road noise. That's usually what I say after. So today I want to talk a little bit about... I have been thinking about, like, different aesthetics of design, which is so, like, silly. It's very silly. But I've been thinking about, like, Frutiger Arrow, Corporate Memphis, Utopian Scholastic, Global Village Coffee House, some of those aesthetics that if you were growing up in the 90s into the 2000s, you will remember. So that definitely dates me as a person of a certain age. But I guess, like, before I get into aesthetics specifically, I want to talk a little bit about a couple radio ads that I recently heard. One very recently, one, I don't know, a few months ago maybe. The first, chronologically, let's go back a few months. So the radio ad that I heard for, it was for Amazon Fulfillment Services, I think for, like, you know, it was Amazon advertising their warehouse jobs, the people who work at the fulfillment centers and, you know, find stuff in bins and, like, you know, pack boxes and prep them for shipping. I don't know fully what goes into that job, and I fully admit, I probably don't have it in me to do that. Like, I don't think I would be... I mean, it's a demanding job to everyone, and that is pretty common knowledge, unfortunately, that... not unfortunate that it's common knowledge, but unfortunate that that seems to be the case across all of these fulfillment centers. But I don't want to get too much or too bogged down in that, but just to say, this advertisement... It was from the perspective, and oh my god, I don't know, I can't stand radio ads where it's, like, presented as, like, a confessional or someone giving an interview for some reason, like, they're on the couch at, like Stephen Colbert or, I don't know, I was gonna say Jimmy Kimmel, like, what's a show that is, a late night show that is still going on, I guess, but, like, they're on the couch... You know, there's, like, a host, like, leaned over a desk, you know, holding a mug, like, hanging on the guest's every word. And the guest is kind of, like, you know, got arm up on the back of the sofa and, like, maybe, like, a leg crossed. And they're just kind of, like, riffing, just talking about, like, their thing, their work, you know, their life. Because they are a person of interest. Except in this scenario, concocted by... the twisted minds at Amazon Fulfillment Services. This was an ad about where the person in the confessional on the sofa was talking about how they saw an ad. This was an ad about how a person saw an ad about working at Amazon in a fulfillment center, and they. We're talking about how, like, oh, I knew it was, like, perfect for my son. He's, like, you know, I don't know how... I don't recall exactly specifically how precise they were with the language, but heavily communicated that they were the parent, the middle-aged parent of an adult child who lived at home in their basement and spent a lot of time playing video games. So this is for the parents who think, like, go out and get a real job. Like, enough with this, like, trying to be a SoundCloud rapper or whatever. Like, go do an honest day's labor for Jeff Bezos. The premise was this person describing their kid, like, in kind of, you know, I won't say unloving, but slightly unflattering terms. Let's leave it there, I guess. As being kind of like a basement goblin, like a neat who, you know, is just like sucking down resources in their household and doesn't have a real job. And they were like, yeah, hey, so my kid, I got them in, you know, I put this job in front of their face, and they were like, oh, wow, yes, a reality exists beyond Plato's cave. I can have a job. I can get a job. And they went out, pounded the pavement, and they got a job at Amazon. And now they have money to get a new gaming computer. And then, like, cue some bleeps and bloops as though, like, the video games that this kid, quote-unquote, adult, is playing are, like, you know, Tetris or Space Invaders or something. So that was that ad. It was pretty much selling the idea of get your lazy bones kid out of your basement, get them, like, you know, bringing in some bacon for the household by sending them off to work at Amazon. And it's kind of, in that sense, kind of a perfect sell, because, like, if, you know, it's widely known that jobs at Amazon are sort of grueling, then, like, hey, maybe you don't want to have that job. Maybe if that job was advertised to you, you'd be like, pass. But if that job is advertised to you to saddle your ungrateful adult neat child in, then great. You know, here, like, learn the value of a dollar and the value of a day's work and so forth. And, like, so you can kind of, you can see the angle. It's like kind of, I don't know, it makes me feel things, negative things, but really what I'm getting at is that sometimes selling something isn't based on selling it directly to you as the consumer, but like selling the idea of something to you that you co-sign or believe in or whatever, selling you on something that if it started showing up in or around your life, that you would be supportive of it or accepting of it. That's the idea. And I think there's maybe some adjacency to that concept and aesthetics. Like, you don't have to directly enjoy this. You don't have to. Some of these aesthetics that I mentioned at the top of the show, Global Village Coffee House, Utopian Scholastic, Frutiger Arrow, they're very strong aesthetics, and you might not want to consume solely those aesthetics. You might think, okay, well, great, but, like, I can't change my whole wardrobe to Utopian Scholastic. That's not going to work. But certain products at certain times, or, you know, things in certain contexts, you might be like, well, hell yeah, this isn't real if it's not Utopian Scholastic. You know, like, maybe you don't want to get your kid a picture book if it's not Utopian Scholastic, like, or a, you know, one of the DK, like, explainer books about things. Like, maybe you wouldn't get an educational you know, grade appropriate picture book if there weren't pictures or something. And, like, maybe part of being age appropriate is having pictures. But, like, maybe if it was like a hardcover cloth bound book with the same contents, it wouldn't jump out at you on a shelf. But the upsell of Utopian Scholastic is, like, the bombastic, like, you know, it communicates this is a book for children and this is an educational book for children when used on a book. Like, obviously, there are other contexts you might find Utopian Scholastic. So that's kind of that's sort of the premise for the Amazon ad. I do want to talk about the other one because it was so funny to me. And again, person of a certain age, I suppose, but there was an ad that I think the Apple Podcasts app just inserts ads for monetized podcasts. I don't 100% know how that works because this is clearly not a monetized podcast. But the ad was for Smucker's peanut butter, and it was narrated by a mom who, you know, the first line is like, I'm making this peanut butter and jelly for me. I say it's for my kids, but it's also for me, which is such a weird way to talk about food. In my mind, like, they're eating it and gaining nutrition from it and having their hunger satisfied by it. But, you know, it also is doing something for me. And I don't know, if that something is convenience, then maybe, but that seems like a stretch, Mama. Anyway, she goes on to say, like, to use some incredibly, like, and I don't even think of this as, like, older millennial, like, so I guess younger millennials or late Gen Z are at the stage where, you know, they're, like, parents, they have young kids that they need to make, you know, they need to help keep alive by feeding peanut butter and jellies too. And so the narration goes on to say, like, you know what, Smucker's, actually, it still slaps. It's the OG peanut butter spread. And when they said OG, I was kind of like, oh, okay. I guess that's colloquial enough. That's, like, trickled into the mainstream. But then, you know, then the actually it still slaps, I was like, oh, okay, guys. So then the other funny line was, it's giving nostalgia. It's giving lunchtime. It's giving nourishment. Something like that. It was really goofy. They stopped short, but they could have totally said something like, my kids, I love that for them. I don't know, it was really leaning into a certain character, a certain profile. Oh yeah, it's giving, you're trying, Mama. Something like that. And like, damn. Sometimes, I guess I'm used to, like, food for kids, like cereals or like sugary drinks or candy, you know, and some other kind of snacky stuff. Like I remember like Heinz purple ketchup and stuff like that. That was all heavily sold to children, marketed to children. And it was kind of novel for me to see a peanut butter ad that was so brazenly marketed to parents. Like, I feel like I've seen peanut butter ads. I don't know, how many peanut butter ads have I fucking seen? I don't know. But I feel like I've seen ads of this ilk where the sell is more like, you know, if you were going to hear it on the radio, it would be narrated by, like, an old man with, like, a country drawl, and he'd be talking about how, like, you know, they like, you know, farm the peanuts in, like, Appalachian, Georgia or something, and then they, like, you know, fire roast them for extra flavor and use all natural sea salt or, I don't know, I guess these are claims that you can only make if they're true, for the most part. So maybe Smucker's is just, like, they're not fire roasting, they're not using sea salt. But, you know, I'm kind of thinking, like, that's usually the kind of, like, food marketing that I see for adults. Like, either this will help you achieve your weight loss goals and help you be, like, cool and trendy, or it tastes really good, or it's, like, sustainable and green and, you know, good for the earth and, you know, God loves you for eating this brand of peanut butter because of that. That's more commonly the kind of marketing that I come across. And I guess, like, Smucker's peanut butter, like, kids aren't buying it. You know, this is the thing with a lot of marketing to children. Like, they can only provide demand. They can't actually pull the trigger on a purchase, for the most part. Like, for like, toys, you know, children's games that aren't appealed, don't appeal to, like, teenagers or older. So, like, you know, you have this brand that adults aren't really going to be consuming. Like, they're, you know, adults are going to be into, like, you know, Sun Butter or, like, some kind of, like, either something that's healthy peanut butter, or it's going to be, like, old country style peanut butter. And, you know, if they're buying it for their kids and, you know, the quality or whatever is not really a concern. For one thing, this ad assuaged the guilt of the mother who is buying, you know, this, like, kind of mid-tier peanut butter for her kid. Or peanut butter that is, like, you know, it's sweet, it's sugary, like, whatever. Not like a health food. Assuage the guilt, and also to, like, kind of, you know, say, hello, fellow adults. And I think that was the aspect of it that was so jarring to me. To use, like, slang exclusively used by adults in such a way as to, like, cozy up to them. You just don't see a lot of that. It was kind of whack. Anyway, let's get back onto the subject of aesthetics. So, I had, like, a handful that I wanted to lay out. We'll see if we delve into any others, because there certainly are other design aesthetics and styles that we recognize very broadly from, like, graphic design and stuff like that. Like, you could say there's, like, I don't know if I could put a name to it. I'm sure there is one. I couldn't put a name to it, but, like, an aesthetic that's kind of, like, hippie, crunchy granola, sort of, like, a lot of papyrus, maybe that font from the 70s with the kind of, like, liquid, oozy-looking letters, stuff like that. But, you know, I'm thinking of, like, a more cohesive design language than just, like, a couple fonts, you know? Like, there's more to it. So let's start with Global Village Coffee House, because I had mentioned that one earlier. Now, Global Village Coffee House, as the name would imply, you would see it a lot in coffee shops, and not just independent coffee shops, but remember, like, back in the day, back in the 90s, Starbucks was new. There were not Starbucks across the country in every, like, small town. Like, you know, nowadays you can get off the highway in, you know, get off the interstate, like, in Indiana, and, like, you know, right off, like, you know, what is it, 290? I'm bad with road names. In, like, Elkhart, Indiana, there's, like, a Starbucks. And that was just not the case. And, you know, if you weren't there, then take my word for it. Starbucks used to be, like, a hipster thing. And it really wasn't until the 2010s where any consumption from Starbucks or product at Starbucks was considered, like, basic. And that was kind of with, like, you know, the advent of the pumpkin spice latte and the sort of, you know, type of, like, profile of young woman who is really into the PSL and, like, Taylor Swift and stuff like that. I feel like these are all kind of adjacent, or, you know, like, there's a strong probability that if you like one, you might like others. So anyway, yeah, where does this lead us? Global Village Coffee House. You'd see it in Starbucks. You'd see it in, like, smaller national or regional coffee chains, like the, you know, Caribou to a degree, Pete's, and other, like, independent coffee houses. It was, like, Okay, so another aesthetic that's kind of related is Fraserbane. Fraserbane came from, and it's a portmanteau, I'm just realizing now. Fraserbane is a portmanteau of Fraser, which I recognize that part. I'm gonna pat myself on the back for that. It's a portmanteau of Fraser, the 90s sitcom about the, well, I'm just gonna use the other half of the portmanteau, Urbane. Seattle dweller, and his, like, you know, urbane, cultured brother, and the blue-collar working-class people, like, their father, that, surround them, and, you know, so Fraser Urbane, a lot of, like, kind of yellowy, orangey stained woods. I guess the concept of that is, like, if you're staining your wood a light stain, then maybe the grain of it shows up a little bit more. I don't know if, honestly, like, I'm not wired in enough with the woodworking to know if seeing grain in wood is a positive or a negative. It feels like the kind of thing that could be a negative that I would find cool, or is, like, viewed as, like, oh, well, if you're using wood with that, like, noticeable a grain, then it's, like, poor quality wood from the outside of the, you know, it's not like the tight, okay, I think I'm reverse engineering this. I feel like I have seen before, like, wood planks from sawn from the inner segment of a log, the grain is more consistent. You don't get, like, wide waves so much. So maybe that's it. Maybe it's not to show off the grain, but, like, to show off a relative lack of grain. And so Fraserbane, like, you have a lot of light stains maybe for that purpose. I'm not sure. I'm just speculating. But yeah, so Fraserbane, kind of adjacent to Global Village Coffee House. Global Village Coffee House was very worldly, like, drawing on a lot of influences from South America and Africa and Southeast Asia, you know, places where coffee beans are grown and harvested around the, and I feel like woodcut art, where there's, like, kind of some, like, noise in the picture, is very, very common in Global Village Coffee House. A lot of sort of deep, bold colors, where you'd have, like, a really, like, royal purple, or, you know, a jade green, sort of a regal blue, things like that. Really bold, kind of gem-toned, saturated colors. And, yeah, a lot of visual noise. Like, even apart from the woodcut sort of aesthetic, I think of a lot of, like, this is an earlier aesthetic with the that I'm about to get into, but, like, the kind of, like, squiggles and shapes sort of motif from, like, the 80s into the 90s. That sort of stuff, I could, you know, you could imagine seeing, like, you could imagine seeing kind of evolve into Global Village Coffee House. Yeah, a lot of, maybe some, like, kind of, indigenous American inspiration, like, you know, maybe, like, a Cocopelli figure playing a flute, would not be a not go awry, not be unheard of in this sort of aesthetic. So, yeah, Global Village Coffee House, I like. It has, like, maybe a little touch of that kind of 90s, and this isn't why I like it, but, you know, I'm just saying, like, it has maybe a smidge of that kind of 90s appropriative sort of flavor. Like, you know, white people in the 90s kind of discovered indigenous aesthetics and motifs and art, and as well as, you know, those of, like, places in the global South or more generally underrepresented in American culture, and decided to extrapolate those into the design language of coffee shops for some reason. And other stuff. Like, I remember restaurants that had the Global Village Coffee House aesthetic. I don't know if this is quite in the same wheelhouse, but you've probably seen some of that mass-produced. I mean, maybe. I don't know. I don't know what you've seen. I don't take responsibility for the things you've seen. But maybe you've seen some of those sort of mass-produced, like, Italian chef pieces of art that you'd see in, like an Italian restaurant. Like a kind of a portly man with a mustache and, like, dark hair and, like, you know, the kind of classic, like, chef's, what do they call that hat? Kind of classic, like, chef's hat, and maybe he's holding, like, a wooden spoon or a whisk, or maybe he has, like, a red bandana or something. Maybe he's holding, like, a mixing bowl. Sorry, going over some bumps. Should be over momentarily. But yeah, I feel like the kind of, like, and maybe, like, the proportions are a little wacky. Like, it's not a very naturalistic portrait of an adult human. Like, he's got kind of, like, a big head or something. And, like, maybe the backdrop, if this is, like, a painting, there's, like, a backdrop that's, like, again, like, kind of visually noisy, like, brightly colored. Maybe not brightly, but, like, high saturated colored backdrop of some sort. So that's kind of, I think that's in the same realm as Global Village Coffee House. And that's also, to me, in my mind, very 90s, like kind of peak 1997. The font Joker Man is kind of in this neighborhood. Just the sort of bombast, the silliness of it, the fact that you can totally imagine it. Okay, this is a little bit of a sidebar, but I think it's gonna make some of this other stuff maybe make sense. In the 90s, if you wanted to make something, some kind of graphic design, anything, you were probably, if you're like a consumer, if you're an average person, you do not have Canva, you do not have Photoshop or GIMP or Illustrator or what's the free version of Illustrator? Inkscape. You don't have that stuff. What you do maybe have is a computer running, like, Windows 95, 98, something like that. And, you know, if you have Microsoft Office, you have Publisher, which is, again, kind of like the free version of Illustrator. Well, no, InDesign is the free version of that for, like, laying out, like, a page for print. You've got ClipArt, which, you know, heavily circulated, gets a lot of traction, just because it's what you got, what you have access to as part of your operating system. You have ClipArt, you have a number of fonts, and you have, like, either a black and white laser jet printer or maybe, like, you know, an inkjet, like, cartridge color printer. That takes a lot of time to print with, by the way. Like, that, there were not really commercially available for at-home use. There were not really such a thing as color laser jet printers. So if you wanted to print something in color, depending on how much color it needed, it was going to take a while, because you were waiting for this cartridge to, like, track back and forth on this page, and it to, like, you know, like, each time it would, like, shoot out another, like, millimeter or something. Like, it was kind of a slow process. So if you were making a bunch of handouts for something, or a flyer, or a poster on a home printer, like, that took a lot of time. if you were trying to make something a little bit faster, you were probably going to, like, offshore a lot of your, the kind of creative, like, pop of this print material to a wacky font. Because, again, like, computers, relatively new in the grand scheme of things. Like, Comic Sans, Papyrus, Joker Man, Impact, even, had not worn out their welcome. They had not, like, nowadays, we know Impact is, like, the meme font. And if you saw it in any kind of serious context, you would laugh at it. And, like, Papyrus, it's, you know, like, Papyrus and Sans are, like, characters in Undertale. Like, these fonts have been memed on heavily. But there was a time before that was the case, believe it or not. So, where this gets us, you know, if you want to add, like, a little creative spark to a thing that you're doing, you're going to use a font or clip art or word art. And, like, the fonts could be pretty wacky. And the clip art, you know, maybe it wasn't exactly what you were looking for, but it was part of a coherent design language with whatever the hell Microsoft decided to put in Windows 95, 98, what have you. So, this is kind of my important point. That, like, a lot of, you needed help, you know? Like, if you weren't a graphic designer, like, I just remember from my time in the late 90s seeing some of these fonts everywhere. Like, I can almost, I don't have a specific example in mind, but I can vividly call up, like, a worksheet or, like, a handout that I was supposed to take home from school for, like, the parent-teacher associations, like, you know, wine and appetizer night or something. I don't know. Was that a thing? Am I making something up? Probably. I can call up a flyer that's on, like, hot pink or, like, you know, bright orange paper, and it has a heading that's in, like, a font that nobody uses anymore. That was not it. But yeah, so Global Village Coffee House, a little bit excessive, a little over the top. The other thing is, like, again, computers are new, people don't have standards for how they should be used correctly, and computers aren't very powerful. Like, I mentioned, you know, having Windows 95 or 98 graphics and clip art, that was actually, like, a huge leap into the future. Because in a previous time, if you wanted that stuff, if you wanted clip art, you had to get, like, a $800 set of floppy disks that had those art assets in them that you had, you know, that would come with, like, the license to use. And you would have to, like, laboriously, like, find them in this warren of floppy disks and transfer them from those discs to whatever you were working on. And I missed that period of time, thankfully. I came in during the future. But the point is, I'm going to stop saying that because I'm not approaching a point. We know this by now. But yeah, it was the future. Clip art was, like, new and exciting. It hadn't worn out its welcome yet. People would use these assets in bombastic ways. And the other thing was, like, the internet was a place that you went to. It wasn't a state of being like it is right now. And I'm hoping this episode doesn't come off as, like, a boomer yelling at clouds, but, like, you know, this is, like, I think the great, I don't know if it's, like, a trauma or, like, a unifying experience for the millennial generation, but to go through this, to see the world pre and post, is, like, continually mind-blowing. And if you interact with any millennials, that's just like something you gotta bear in mind if you're younger or if you're older. I mean, if you're older, you lived through the pre and post also. But maybe it was different for you because you were already like a working adult or already retired when phones came out. And it's so different now, like, you know, living through the core of your like formative years or your young adulthood through those experiences. Anyway. Yeah, so if you, like, and what I want to return to, the internet being a place, like, you had to go to a home computer or a computer in a computer lab at school or work, and that was where you would use the computer from, and using the computer was not synonymous with using the internet. Like, nowadays, you know, Windows 11, Windows 10 even, like, you open your start menu, you start typing, it's going to try to search the internet. You know, it's going to try to find results not just in your computer, not just in files or folders that you have created, but from other computers. And that was not always the case. Like, the internet was part of the experience of using a computer, but there was a lot of software that existed solely offline. Like, the cloud was not, you know, unilaterally part of the experience of using the computer. I mean, the cloud in the 90s, 2000s didn't exist, really. At least in so many words. Like, people didn't really have an understanding of, like, saving something to the internet. Anyway, so, you know, you'd, like, use your computer, you do offline stuff, you do some online stuff, but that was, like, a place in your house. You could not access the internet when you were, like, at a red light. You could not access the internet, you know, on a walk. You could not access the internet when you're, like, you know, out to dinner at a restaurant, and, like, arguing about, like, you know, no, what was the year that, Anchorman came out? Like, that wasn't a thing. Like, computer was at home. Internet was at home. And in a lot of, like, middle class and up families, like, or households, like, it was maybe, like, in the den. Maybe there was, like, a computer room, like, a space for that. That was, like, a permanent desktop computer that you would access for the internet. But I think there's something, like, incredibly psychologically transformative about going from that time to going to a time where you have the internet on your phone, which is always in your pocket, and you have unlimited data, or, like, it's trivial to get on the internet. There's no concern of load times. There's, you know, internet access and cell towers, like, everywhere. You know, you have to be in, like, the middle of, like, the Grand Canyon to not have internet these days, or, like, be, like, right on the water. So, one of those things that I don't think a lot of people have, like, really reckoned with has changed the way they use the internet. And even after you had phones, even after, like, smartphones came into prominence, which, like, now, the only people I know that have quote-unquote dumb phones or, like, track phones are people who have specifically gone back to them as a way to combat phone addiction. Like, nobody still has a track phone or something because, like, they just never upgraded. Like, it's been, like, 15 years since phones, you know, at least 10 years at this point, since, you know, dumb phones, like, kind of stopped being a thing you could upgrade into. Even, like, my older relatives, they all have, like, iPhones and stuff. Because, because, like, at some point, their younger family members were like, oh, this would be so great so that we could put, like, you know, audiobooks on, you know, grandpa's phone, or we could, like, you know, add an app that has, like, medication reminders or whatever, and alerts, or, you know, we can, like, make it easy for them to contact us, or for us to send, like, kid photos or whatever. I think that's another thing that maybe, like, people still kind of assume, like, oh, well, older people or, like, older generations don't have the same facility with technology. And that's, you know, I think increasingly being proven not solely, not unilaterally the case. Like, you have older people now who have had smartphones since they came out. You have older people now who have been using computers for like 30 years of their career until they retired. You know, you have people now who are younger who grew up with phones being really easy, and it was never a problem for them to, you know, like, once they learned the kind of haptic language of operating a phone or device with a touchscreen, they kind of stopped learning, like, keyboarding or learning, like, you know, how to use a file directory or, like, how to do the kind of basic coding that you would have learned if you ever had, like, a MySpace page or a Neopets account. Anyway, this is veering very heavily towards, you know, Boomer Yells at Cloud, so I'm going to kind of swing back over to like movements of design. But yeah, Global Village Coffee House, maximalist for sure. Is it one that I enjoy? I like it fairly well. I think it's got to be a small doses thing, and I think the other thing about Global Village Coffee House that kind of sells it for me, if anything does, is that it creates a vibe in the space where it's used, where it's deployed. Like, you know, your coffee shop, you feel so urbane and worldly, and, like, I'm sampling this brew from, like, the Isle of Borneo. You know, like, there's just something about it that kind of enhances the experience for, like, an American from, like, you know, the Midwest, at least. So moving on, I guess, like, there was one thing I wanted to say during that rant about technology, that the computer being a place that you could go, like, I think people generally used to be a little bit hungrier for stimulation, for visual stimulation, at minimum. I think it was harder to, you had to, like, put in a little bit more effort to see something or consume something that would be, like, interesting to your senses. And nowadays I think we have the opposite problem, where the average person is visually and, you know, sensorily overstimulated almost constantly, because, again, you know, you have your like, phone, you know, you open your phone, you go to Reddit, you go to Instagram, you go to TikTok, you know, you go to your apps of choice and, like, you know, swipe past, like, a million things and, like, can't really process all of them. It's, like, sort of too much for your brain. And I think that's why maybe minimalism is really, like, coming back and has been for a number of years, and probably will stay even after, like, the tastemakers kind of decide that it's like chooky. It's all because, like, you know, your brain appreciates the break, appreciates looking at nothing. And maybe that's an explanation for why in the pre, before the era of internet ubiquity, so many of these aesthetics from like the 80s and 90s were just bombastic, all over the place, a million different colors and textures and just so much going on. Because it was more to look at, and that was at a time where that wasn't a burden. So, yeah, final word on Global Village Coffee House. Next one I want to talk about, Utopian Scholastic. I touched on it a little bit. And this is, of course, the aesthetic that I associate with, like, textbooks. There was that, I can't remember the name of the program that, you know, you would get the, like, if you were a grade school student back in, like, I don't know, like, the, again, late 90s, early 2000s, teacher would, like, wheel out a giant, like, tube TV on an AV cart and, like, put in a VHS cassette about, like, you know, some topic in, like, science or natural history or whatever. And it would start with that intro with, like, the kind of, like, sort of tropical-sounding, like, soaring, like, flute solo or, like, pan pipes kind of solo. I don't know the instrument. And, you know, it'd be, like, you're, like, on a kind of floating camera rig, like, soaring through these rooms where there's, like, and, like, a chameleon walking by, and there's a tiger, and, like, there's a T-Rex skeleton, and there's, like, a Leonardo da Vinci flying machine, and you got, like, a Model T Ford and stuff like that. Just, like, again, like, all of these aesthetics, the thing that's being communicated is, like, this is science. This is what science looks like. Or this is what, like, at least, like, the sciences that are taught to children, because, you know, chemistry, like, okay, you know, like, Dexter's lab, like, some guy, like, pouring green stuff into a test tube, or, like, from a test tube into a beaker, in a lab coat, like, that's fine, but that was, like, an aesthetic from entertainment, from, like, movies and TV and cartoons and stuff. Like, you would not be exposed to that aesthetic so much through school. But the educational stuff, it was like, yeah, let's talk about, you know, biology, technology. And not biology in the sense of, like, let's learn about the parts of a cell or about how, like, sunlight is converted into energy by plants through photosynthesis. Like, not that level of stuff. Not about, like, you know, like, you know, like, the, like, sort of population maintenance, needs of, like, a community of, like, gray wolves or whatever. That's more like the kind of high school biology stuff, but, like, at least in my mind. But, you know, I'm thinking more of, like, learning about animals and, like, you know, the what's the difference between a reptile and an amphibian kind of stuff. Anyway, so Utopian Scholastic, characterized by, like, very clean, you know, white backdrops over which would be overlaid, like, this total panoply, this abundance of, like, you know, colorful animals and like, technology and just stuff, science stuff, educational stuff. Like, maybe, you know, bridging a little bit out from the sciences, you might see, like, here's, like, a feather quill and, like, a scroll of parchment or something, because this is the, you know, reading portion of your utopian scholastic education. A lot of bubbles. I don't know how I would explain that exactly. Oh, and if you ever have seen the original Google logo, maybe not the very, very first one, but the one that was the standard of Google until they kind of went towards that more flat sans serif font. Google, it used to be a serif font. The lowercase g was kind of the symbol. And again, like, this is kind of part of the process of broadening and diversifying into a global market, because a lowercase g, like, that might not make the g sound in other languages, or you know, maybe you're using a script where a g is just a nonsense symbol. But colors, symbols, you know, if the symbol doesn't mean anything to anyone, it's just like a wheel, like a pie chart of three different colors or something, like, that's not a letter. That does not carry any linguistic meaning. So that's equally applicable across the planet. Anyway, the original, or that, like, early Google logo that stuck around for a good number of years, that I think of as being kind of adjacent to utopian scholastic. Yeah, if you Google, like children's textbooks from the 90s, or if you can, like, call up any, you know, from your own memory, like, that's the vibe. If you can think of, like, a gift store at a museum, like, at a, like, the gift store at, like, a zoo or an aquarium or planetarium or, like, a science and technology museum for kids, like, a children's museum gift store, like, that is the look. You know, it's welcoming, it's warm, it's friendly, it's upbeat, and then at the same time, it's also, like, just absolutely zany with shit. That all has kind of an educational flair, but is also oriented to the kind of stimulation that kids crave. Maybe uniquely, or maybe at that time more uniquely. Okay. So, what else? I want to talk about corporate Memphis a little bit. Let's do Frutiger Arrow. So Frutiger Arrow, I think, is, like, really comes of age in the new millennium. Like, I don't really think it was much of a thing in the late 90s, but, like, early 2000s, well into the mid-2000s, even the late 2000s, it was a very dominant aesthetic. And it was associated with technology. Like, a lot of the graphical, you know, user interface of the popular operating systems at the time, like, early Mac OS and, like, what else? Windows XP. Heavily influenced by Frutiger Arrow. I think there are other flavors of Frutiger as well, but Arrow is probably the best known and the most popular. And you'd see a lot of, like imagine, like, a Windows XP desktop background with, like, some of the default backgrounds that came with the operating system. You have, like, maybe some, like, a cityscape, but it's surrounded by like fields of bright green, and maybe there's like some leaves involved in it, like motifs of leaves, bubbles, maybe like some water, some like real like juicy looking splash of liquid. That's all very Frutiger Arrow. A lot of like, you know, soft blues and charming greens. Like those are the colors that you would often see. Maybe like some kind of maybe a little saucier, you'd see some like kind of sunset colors. I think of the famous like Apple iPhone, or not before the iPhone, the iPod commercials with the black silhouettes of people like jamming out on an iPod with like the white, you know, earbud cords dangling, and the white iPod in hand. I think of that as being very kind of Frutiger Arrow. Maybe it was like kind of what Frutiger Arrow was starting to turn into, but yeah. And you think of like the home screen, the operating system home screen from like some early or like console video game systems of that era, like the Xbox 360. There's a lot of like round edges. All the visuals look kind of soft, kind of squishy, pillowy, wet even. White is used, but it's also like a little softer. It's not like a bright, stark white. Usually it's kind of muted, maybe like an egg kind of eggshell white, or ivory even, something like that. Like I think of that especially with like the Xbox graphics, Xbox 360. Trying to think if I wasn't like PlayStation 2 didn't really get in on that craze, and oh, I guess you could say the Nintendo Wii. That was the first Nintendo console that really had like a landing screen. Like I guess the GameCube, kind of. You know, the like do like that thing with the GameCube little box. There was kind of like a squishiness, softness to that. I kind of wonder if that was just partly like the state of the technology at that time. Of like CGI rendering. Like it was easier to make something that was kind of soft and maybe almost like a touch blurry, because if you start getting hard edges, like your screens can only like you're gonna start to see some like jagged like pixels. So I wonder if the blur was kind of to compensate for that, the softness was to compensate for that. Anyway, Frutiger Arrow, very heavily associated with technology, and you would not really see it in a lot of other contexts. Like, I'm trying to imagine, like, a commercial even that used Frutiger Arrow. You would definitely never see it in something like a restaurant. Maybe in, like, a technology retailer. Maybe, like, in an airport, you could kind of picture this. But yeah, I might have more to say on that later, but I think you get the picture. Another one that I really enjoy, that's very, you know, present within this era is Memphis. I guess Memphis, and it's complicated. I wouldn't say I enjoy it unequivocally. But Memphis originated in the 80s. I think named after the Memphis Design Group. So it was kind of their in-house, like, style and brand. And, like, if you can picture an old Taco Bell, that is the look. Look up the older Taco Bell logos before they moved to the kind of, like, purple and white ones. But back when it was, like, the kind of blocky bell and there were, like, bars of color, it was a little Southwest-inspired. That was what the Taco Bell restaurants looked like inside, very strongly. Memphis design originated in the 80s. It was, like, heavy color, like, very bright colors. I don't want to say, like, Global Village Coffee House was bright. They were more saturated. But very heavy colors, heavy-handed use of color. A lot of, like, interesting shapes incorporated into functional design, like furniture. And part of the reason, like, maybe, you know, McDonald's, like, the kind of play place sort of aesthetic as well. And the reason that a lot of McDonald's has stopped having play places, for one thing, insurance. But another reason was that, and, you know, another reason they moved away from, like, the giant, weirdly shaped fiberglass, like, futons or, you know, like, big kind of goofy statuettes and stuff, is that if that McDonald's goes out of business, it's a lot easier to flip a building that doesn't fucking look like a McDonald's, that doesn't have giant, you know, like, the golden arches and, like, fry motif over the awning. Same goes for Pizza Hut and the iconic roof shape, or Taco Bell. Like, you know, you can, you drive by buildings like this and you can say, like, oh yeah, it's in, like, the car insurance, you know, like take a left at the car insurance place that used to be a Taco Bell. Like, yeah, I love the new Euro place that opened up in the old, you know, converted Pizza Hut. Yeah, it's just, it's easier to get more bang for your buck if you have to sell one of those buildings. Because again, like, another part of the scheme, and this is why, this is why, like, this is why car washes are so commonplace. It's not that everyone, that there's such an intense desire and demand for keeping your car clean, but that they take very little staff to operate. They are very, you know, you get the equipment set up. That's, like, the bulk of the expense. They don't need to make a lot of money to be profitable because, again, low overhead, low staff. And then once you get your car wash, like, the land that it sits on paid off, then you can sell it. You know, then you're not leasing anymore. Like, you can sell it for a bunch of money because you own the deed. Or you can, like, I don't know, keep operating it as a car wash and, like, just make a ton of money on that because you're not paying rent anymore. And I think a similar principle goes for McDonald's. Like, McDonald's is not just a fast food chain. It is a real estate company. And they want to keep their restaurants in business to the point that those, you know, take this with a grain of salt because I'm not an expert. I don't even know if McDonald's is franchised, owned and operated or not, or if it's, like, more of, like, a big, you know, I don't even have the language to describe it, like, conglomerate, you know, corporate, operated sort of thing. But McDonald's, like, it's to their benefit, you know, whatever the model is, whatever the case may be, it's in their benefit to keep their businesses profitable till the point that, you know, they own that land. that the restaurant sits on, and then they can sell it and do whatever else, do something that's maybe more profitable now that they have like a big pile of seed money. I don't know, again, not an expert. Anyway, so part of the reason corporate, or, you know, Memphis design started fading, was because even though it was eye-catching and splashy and memorable, it also cost a lot of money for those installations. And also it kind of impacted the, you know, future resale value. It's the same reason Millennial Gray caught on. Like, not because there was, you know, sure, there were influencers who were pushing it, but why did it catch on? Like, there were influencers for maximalism or the quote-unquote grand millennial style. You know, there are influencers for everything, but why, what attracted all this money to Millennial Gray and that sort of style, even though it is kind of, like, bereft of spirit? The thing that attracted all the money was the fact that, you know, end of the day, like, if your house is, like, a blank canvas for, you know, visitors to project themselves onto, that makes it easier to sell, or that increases your sale value. And, you know, I know a lot of people, some people who are buying homes or want to buy homes, who are kind of like, yeah, but, like, you're just then kind of renting it to the next owner while you're living there. And I know other people who are like, I don't want to ever sell this house. Like, I bought this house. I bought this house. My plan is to live here, you know, and pay off this mortgage in 30 years and then not have a mortgage anymore, you know. And, like, that's, it's not an investment to them, except in themselves, you know. Like, it's not an investment in the sense that they want to, They're hoping to, like, you know, squeeze some juice from it eventually. Like, that's not the play. But anyway, so Millennial Gray. I think because when, you know, the housing market started taking its turn in, like, 2008, the seeds were sown. And, like, yeah, I guess it's more attractive to people if they can, if they have to sell their house to get more money out of it. And, you know, hey, you can call it an aesthetic. You can say this was on purpose and it wasn't just, you know, so I can, like, make little sacrifices of my own, so I can sacrifice my own little, you know, comfort, happiness, joy, feeling of creative or artistic expression, just so I can juice a little more money out of it. Because, hey, it is creative expression. It's an aesthetic. And I think maybe there's an element to the internet thing I talked about earlier. Like, if you are overstimulated constantly by, you know, the fucking Palantir that you carry around in your pocket at all times, then maybe having your surroundings be cool, neutral, and understimulating is, like, kind of a reprieve. That would not be the calculus. I would make a different decision. I would be like, no, I want my house to reflect my personality and to be filled with things that bring me joy. And if I gotta cut back on my phone because it's overstimulating me, that is the preferable and more needful and honestly better for everyone solution. But that's just me. And I guess by the same token, I rent right now. I rent an apartment where the walls are renter white, and the only, like, pop of color or excitement design-wise is, like, my furniture and the art that I've hung up, which I feel pretty good about, to be clear. But, you know, yeah, maybe if I tiled, you know, my kitchen floor in pennies, as I've been saving pennies to do for many years, then maybe I would feel differently. I don't know. Okay, so, yeah, Frugor Arrow, I touched on, like, Millennial Gray and some of the other, like, counter movements in design among millennials. Touched on Memphis. Yeah, corporate Memphis is the next evolution. Corporate Memphis is the level where you have, like, the flat kind of character art. People who are... people who are, you know, have skin tones that do not really exist in nature, like blue or purple or, you know, whatever, like mint green or what have you. Like, the purpose is to, in a very, like, broadly acceptable corporate way, again, kind of like with Google and their move from, with Google and their move away from that serif typeface and, you know, G kind of logo mark. You know, corporate Memphis is an attempt to be palatable to everyone without really speaking to anyone. There's kind of a variation on corporate Memphis, like you'll see, not just with Google's like logo, but also, you know, when you're looking at Google's like their help articles, some of the art or like the sign-in page for Gmail, like you will see art that is very kind of bland, kind of has like people with distorted features and bodies, like their bodies are huge and their hands and heads are very tiny. Kind of because, like, the premise is we don't want to depict any specific person or anyone who could look too specifically like a particular, like, race or ethnicity of person, even. Meanwhile, you've got, like, Allegra, which is the sort of flat, colorful, you know, empty design style of Facebook. Their sort of in-house art style, you'll see that there with Facebook as well. Again, think of any of these logos, Google, Facebook, whatever. Like, they moved from a more shiny, rounded, dimensional kind of logo to something that is flat. Why was that? I don't know. I guess that's where I'll end it. So I am at my destination. I thank you all for listening. Your listenership is greatly appreciated. Means so much. I hope if you've been falling asleep that you've enjoyed the white noise here. Thank you as always to Scott Suter for our intro and outro themes for the show. Find him on SoundCloud at Scott Suter, making a lot of really exciting experimental stuff over there. You can also find his band Tiny Stupid on Spotify and other major music platforms, I want to say. And he has a webcomic, Copenhagen Cool Ranch. Check him out online on the socials and whatnot. You can also find me online at www.letmeexplainyouathing.com. Suggest topics to me there if you choose, at your peril. Anyway, thank you guys for listening. Stay groovy. I will see you next time. Bye-bye.